Hey everybody, we just finished recording today's show and I'm still laughing about the tiki talkers at the end, but I just want to record a quick message here for our listeners in New York City. I'm sorry if that's not you. Please bear with me. I am going to be up in New York this weekend, and on Saturday night, I will be going out to the Cosmos versus the Rowdies game at Hofstra. I didn't even realize that the Rowdies would be up there, but that's my team. I grew up in Tampa. My dad played for them back in the 70s before I was alive, and this season, he joined back up as the general manager. So anyway, when he told me he'd be up there and I knew I would be up there, I thought, that's great. I'll go to the game. And then I thought, well, I'll bring some Howler people, people who work on the mag, on the podcast. And then I thought, you know, let's just open this up to everybody, listeners, readers, anybody who wants to go. So I called the Cosmos. I told them my idea. They're setting aside a block of tickets. The tickets normally cost $25 a piece. They're giving them to us for 18. And if you use the promo code Howler2015, Howler2015, or just click the link on the little blog post that we put up yesterday at howlermagazine.com announcing this little excursion, it will ensure that you get tickets with us. We'll all be sitting together. A couple of other little things. Apparently Franz Beckenbauer and Pelé will be in attendance. Raul will be playing, obviously, for the Cosmos, I think, unless he's injured. But I think he just scored a goal, so I think he'll be there. I spoke with somebody at the Rowdies. They're gonna get us some yellow t-shirts if we can get a sizable group. So we'll have like a little legit away section, which I think will be really fun. I don't think, you know, in North America, we don't really get those away sections all that often. I will be getting up there about an hour and a half before the game. I'm going to stock up on some beer and bring some soccer balls, and we can just sort of meet up in the parking lot and hang out and kick around and have some fun. The Long Island Railroad takes about 35 minutes from Penn Station to Mineola, and there's a free Cosmos shuttle bus that will take you to the stadium and back to Mineola after the game. So anyway, that's it. If you don't live in New York, but think it would be fun to get a small group of Howler people together in your city, drop me a line. On Twitter, I'm at Qureshi, or just email me at george@howlermagazine.com. We don't really do, you know, big glitzy events, but I really, really, really like meeting the people who we make the mag and the podcast for. So I hope you'll be able to come out and spend some time with us either this weekend or in the future. Now, on with the show.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's DUMMY. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Dummy, conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. I'm the editor of Howler, George Qureshi. I'm in Memphis, Tennessee, talking with Danny Carbassian, sitting in his closet. He was lonely, but he's not lonely anymore because he's got me and David Goldblatt on the line. Hey, guys.
How's it going?
All right, George.
We have quite a bit to talk about today, and it's going to range pretty far. I mean, we got the Manchester Derby. We've got Eduardo Galeano's passing, one of the great soccer writers, a real poet. We have Jen Cooper is going to join us later. She's the host of Howler's other podcast, The Mix Zone. We're going to talk about the U.S. Women's World Cup roster. And, of course, we have Tiki Taka after this. I kind of want to start with Eduardo Galeano. That was the biggest news of the week. The passing of one of soccer's great, great artists, intellectuals, just a man whose stature, I mean, God, David, words are failing me here. They rarely fail you. Why don't you talk about him for a minute?
Well, you know, the ball, one of the reasons that The Ball Is Round got written is because I read Football in Sun and Shadow. And then I prefaced my own book with this extraordinary quote. And he wrote, "An astonishing void. Official history ignores football. Contemporary history texts fail to mention it, even in passing, in countries where it has been and continues to be a primordial symbol of collective identity. I play, therefore I am. a style of play as a way of being that reveals the unique profile of each community and affirms its right to be different. Tell me how you play, and I will tell you who you are. And I just thought, oh, the gauntlet is thrown down. I better write that history. You know, in some ways, the ball is round, you know, in the back of my head was one long intellectual and in some ways sort of literary dialogue with Galeana. The book is an extraordinary, pithy, Latin American, magic realist, aphoristic take on the history of world football in like 50, 60 really tiny short pieces. And I responded, you know, on the one hand with mad Anglo-Saxon rigor and organization, and also was just totally inspired by his way of writing about the game. And I ended up writing about 40 match reports in The Ball is Round, which, you know, in their kind of experimental style and kind of their ambition, if not their execution, were totally inspired by Galeano's work. So, you know, we all stand on the shoulders of giants, and I sure as hell stand on his.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, one of the ways that when I talk about you, David, and I explain to people who you are, I say he's to me the first historian to really bring that kind of academic rigor to soccer and you know, write a history of the sport that would stand up in against any history of anything. And I feel the same way about Galeano. His skill as a writer, he could have written about anything, and he chose to look at soccer and look at the absurdity, really, but also the beauty, the things that we all love about it. He was able to take and put into prose. And I mean, it's just picking up his book and opening it at random. I mean, you'll come upon a phrase or a turn of something that makes you go, wow, that, you know, that was incredible. It's really difficult. I find it really difficult to speak about him, and like just with the best writers, my favorite writers. I always run into this problem because my skill is just so limited compared to what they did, and so you really just have to say, go read his stuff.
The other thing with Galeano, it's such a kind of there's a sort of generosity of sort of spirit that kind of shines through the book as well that I find. Yeah, you know, you can get in a way that certainly English football writers had never been so sort of personal or emotional, or imaginative in their way of tackling it. And I think the other thing one's got to remember about Galeano is that he's a Uruguayan. I mean, and it's so amazing that this tiny, tiny country of less than 3 million people has not only won the World Cup twice and sort of, you know, transformed the kind of character of football in a lot of ways in the 20s and 30s, but has also given us, you know, the kind of the Nobel laureate of soccer writing as well. It's just a sort of extraordinary contribution.
I want to do something we don't normally do here, and I want to read something. A couple of issues ago, I think it was issue 3, Galeano was putting out a new book. It was called, at least in English, it was called Children of the Days. Turns out it was his last book. David, you know Carl Bromley, the editor in New York. He's English, but he uh-huh. brought over a bunch of really great foreign writers on English on soccer to the U.S. And published them in English. Guys like Galeano, but also, you know, Jonathan Wilson and Simon Cooper. I was able to get a copy of this, and they gave us 3 little excerpts. They're really small, but I wanted to just read one of these short pieces just to give people a sense. If you haven't read Galeano, of what his writing was like. So good. This, you know, the book was organized into like diary entries. So each one had a date. We published, 3 that all happened to be in July, different years. This one's called My Dear Enemy. It's for July 16th. White was Brazil's jersey, but once the 1950 World Cup showed white to be unlucky, it was never white again. The final match was over. Uruguay was world champion, and the fans would not leave. 200,000 Brazilians had turned to stone in Maracanã Stadium. On the field, a number of players still wandered about. The two best crossed paths, Obdulio and Zizinho. They crossed paths. They eyed each other. They were very different. Obdulio, the victor, was made of steel. Zizinho, the vanquished, was made of music. But they were also very much alike. Both had played nearly the entire championship injured, an inflamed ankle in one case, a swollen knee in the other, and not a complaint was heard from either. Now, at the end of the match, they didn't know if they could give each other a slug or a hug. Years later, I asked Abdulio, "Do you ever see Zizinho?" "Sure, once in a while," he said. "We close our eyes and we see each other." I just thought that was incredibly beautiful. You know, and that's what he does. He takes a scene, something we all see, and sometimes he imagines, sometimes he knows, sometimes he notices more. But he sort of bringing his focus to it, he elevates it. He makes it just special and meaningful in a way. So anyway, I mean,
but playful at the same time.
Totally, totally.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the, you know, there's always a danger in football writing of getting too pompous and too sententious. Yeah. And there's a kind of playfulness and experimental kind of quality to his flights of imagination that constantly undermine that and make the writing so great.
Well, he was also like a stalwart liberal, which I appreciate, you know, someone who really, really championed the left and the ideas of, you know, of the left. And I thought, you know, that's also, it's a different strain. It's something that, I don't know. I don't know if it really crept into his football writing all that much. I think that, you know, he was able to write about a lot of different things and, you know, probably it's part of the reason he's so successful with the soccer writing is that it really is just celebrating. I mean, the things we love and love to look at in soccer, you know.
But with enough of a kind of quietly jaundiced eye to know that, you know, power and money are always around the corner. I mean, it's not his central concern, but they float in the texts, you know. They're in the background, the knowledge of how the thing is shaped and the sort of, you know, the dialectical relationship between the world of play and the world of power just sort of sits quietly. I think in his work.
Yeah, I mean, those are things they're often in the background of what we talk about. I would say the difference is his artistry. I mean, it's just so much more subtle than when we do it. Anyway, I'm glad we could take a minute to talk about Eduardo Galeano.
People go and if you haven't read it, just really go and get it. Go and get a copy. Go read it.
Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of thing you need to sit down and read from start to finish. You open a page, you read it, you put it down, whatever. It's not linear. It's just really great. I mean, and also we'll have the link to this piece that we publish on our page, so you can sort of get a taste of it, or just, you know, spend 10 minutes with it later today. We also want to talk about the Manchester Derby. Danny, can you just give us a real, real brief recap of the game and why we would talk about it now?
United played, you know, City at the weekend. It was the big one on Sunday. Aguero actually got City off to a good start, scored early, and then it was just all Manchester United after that. They scored 4 unanswered goals, and then Aguero scored again right at the end. Going into the end, the tail end of the season, the business end of the season, as they say over in England, it does make the table, you know, a little bit more interesting. Manchester City have had a pretty crazy run of games and results in this new year. They've lost a lot of games recently, and I think a lot of the pressure starting to pile on Pellegrini as well. Liverpool also won on Monday against Newcastle, which means the gap between fifth and fourth is actually getting smaller and smaller as Liverpool kind of creep up on a Champions League place. They're on 57 points. City's on 61. And Manchester United are on 65 now, just a point behind Arsenal, who are actually 7 points behind Chelsea, and Chelsea have a game in hand. So, you know, I don't think Arsenal fans haven't completely written off the title yet, but Chelsea are in great form at the moment. They just keep grinding out wins. But yeah, that Manchester United Man City game, I think it's an important thing because it shows that you know, City right now are in a little bit of trouble. I think they've, you know, Pellegrini's his job has been kind of in question recently. The players are getting questioned now as well. They're saying, is the squad too old? Do they need a bunch of new faces in there now? guys like Samir Nasri and even Yaya Toure, who, you know, even last season, the beginning of this season, was hailed as, you know, one of the Premier League's best players. Like, he's even been linked to, you know, moves away now. Players are getting upset for not playing. Jovetic is a new player there. He's already been linked back to Italy. Edin Dzeko hasn't scored as many goals as he would have been expected to. He's been linked away. So it's an interesting time, I think, for City. And even Patrick Vieira has been, you know, like, you know, and the paper, you can only go by it so much, but even he's been linked to the job if Pellegrini goes. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier to you, George, off the show, it must make for a very interesting work dynamic, when somebody that's, you know, working under you is linked to your job, before you've actually left.
I think the whole thing is interesting. I mean, look, you know, I think when you assemble a group of players like that, people who would be starting at pretty much any other club in the world, you know, you can sort of hold it together when you're winning, right? But then when things get a little tough and you're not, you know, and you're fighting for fourth place, I can imagine it gets a little more tense.
Yeah, and that's what I think. That's what makes it interesting. As you said, when everybody's winning, and you know you're in contention for medals and trophies, and you know everything is going well, I think the players that aren't playing, you know, you're still competitive about it, and you still want to be on the, you know, on the field, but you're also like, well, we're getting the job done, and you know, I'm with a successful team. But when you're not getting results, that's when things start to get interesting. I mean, Manchester City have lost, you know, they just lost to United. They lost to Crystal Palace last week. They lost to Burnley, you know, two or three weeks ago. These are games that they should be definitely winning, you know, and it comes actually on the tail of several good results too, because they beat Newcastle 5-0, and then they also beat Stoke 4-1. So it looked like they were actually turning things around for a second there, but then it got really, really difficult for them. But it does, as I said, it does line up the end of the season to be quite interesting. Arsenal are yet to go to Old Trafford in the league. And that's, I think, our second to last game or third last game. So that should be make for a very, very interesting game.
Well, so, David, you know, when I was looking at this, I had just another sort of forehead slapping moment. And I'm thinking, you know, Manchester City is supposed to be one of, along with Chelsea, earlier this season, we were talking about them being, you know, the unbeatable club. I mean, top two. And again, Frank Lampard is coming off the bench. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, in what other country? Is there an analog to this? I don't think there is. I mean, Raul was gone from Real Madrid. You know, these older players who are sort of like those talismanic players, they fade away in other countries, it feels like. And here we have Lampard still. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
yeah, but what about Totti?
Yeah, no, that's true. But I don't know. I mean,
and you know, what about, come on, you know, let's look at that Milan defense of old when they were, pickling those guys in whatever they do in the space.
Totti didn't retire. Totti didn't, or he didn't leave Roma for, you know, in order to go and sort of cash in the way that, you know, that's the pattern now. You know, it's not like Xavi going and saying, okay, I'm going to start playing for Granada, you know, or, you know, that's a bad example, but, you know,
look at Maldini or Costa Curta, who played to sort of, I mean, virtually till they were 40, no?
Yes.
At Milan. So there is a kind of, you know, Frank Lampard strikes.
But the aspirations of those clubs, we're not talking about a club like City that has decided we're going to go out and basically change, you know, along with Chelsea, change the market for all players. I mean, and basically raise wages so dramatically. These are people who have said we're basically going to try to build, you know, we're going to take super clubs and make them even more super. These are, and I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get stuck on Lampard. I think he's a great player. He's been a very good player. It's felt strange to me though to just see this derby. I was at El Clasico a couple weeks ago. This is one of the Premier games in England, and it felt to me small time in comparison. I mean, I think most things would, but it was surprising.
I think one of the interesting things around Frank Lampard too is that, you know, initially he was meant to, I guess with that whole kind of debacle with New York City FC as well, but he was meant to kind of join back up with New York City at the start of the season. And that was, you know, the first half of the season when City were still in the Champions League. Lampard was he was still scoring goals, like he was coming on and having a pretty big impact. And now he's just it's a shame because, you know, in here in the States, I know I'm sure fans, especially New York City fans, would love to just have him here. And I'm sure for him, it'd be, you know, probably more beneficial as well for the way his career's going too.
Well, yeah, but look, and I took this in a direction that I think I'm regretting because he didn't actually have a very big impact on the game. He's not the person I would really want to focus on here. But I found it telling that he was the substitute. I guess, you know, there's an element of Danny, what you're talking about, City sort of falling apart a little bit. I mean, I don't know how you can call being in fourth really falling apart, but also looking at United is now 4 points clear of City. They came into that game ahead of City. You know, for the past few years, they've been sort of, I mean, the underdogs, if you can call it that. But I think this really sort of redeems, I think, in some ways, Van Gaal's approach and just sort of his tenure there. People were calling him, you know, oh, his record is worse than Moyes, at this point, X point in the season. But, you know, he's done a pretty good job. Can we say that now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's, you know, initially, anytime a new manager comes in, it's going to be hard to just get a bunch of new players that he's not familiar with, especially when, you know, when you come in with the history that you have of being so successful as well. It's I don't think it's easy to come in with a big club like that and really just turn them on their heads like everybody was expecting them to. And, you know, everybody, when you look at Manchester United, you already have these ridiculous expectations anyway that Sir Alex set as well. So it was never going to be an easy job, but he is a very, very good manager, and he's starting to show that as he's gotten more comfortable in the season, the players have gotten more comfortable with him, that they're starting to respect him and play for him, and it's showing on the pitch.
David, this derby, I get the sense a little bit that I mean, you're kind of bored by it, and not that you're being disdainful or anything, but, you know, is there anything, are you interested in the top of the table here in the Premier League at all?
I really wanted, you know, in a strange way, City to be challenging Chelsea. I mean, my kind of, it's rather like voting in the general election here that's about to come up. You know, the first consideration is how do you stop the Conservatives winning, right? Then you think about who you might vote for. And so it is with the Premier League. The first consideration is how can Chelsea not win? You know, and then we pick and choose after that. So, you know, for me, it's like, you know, the coronation of Abramovich's Chelsea, you know, just continues. And I just find that desperately dull and disappointing. So that was really I kind of wanted City to be better so that at least they could keep the fight up for another few games.
I mean, that's kind of dull too, though, right? I mean, a basically a Chelsea clone beating Chelsea is not.
Well, you know, choose your style of oligarch and kind of member of the global super rich. I mean, obviously, it's a pretty unappetizing contrast, but I'd rather, you know, if you force me, I'm going to go with Abu Dhabi over Russia.
Okay. I don't know. I'm kind of unsatisfied with the way things are shaping up here. I guess I'll have to find some interest in the lower leagues. David, you had a pretty good rundown of those a couple weeks ago. But yeah, there's some exciting stuff going on there. I can't get super excited for the top four race these days. It's just the same old people, you know? Maybe I just need a change of scenery. Anyway, that's kind of a downer. I'm going to leave it there. We'll be back in just a minute with an interview with Jen Cooper. She's going to tell us about the Women's World Cup roster.
Hello all, Matt here again, popping up in your podcast like a magical genie, albeit one that is unable to grant you any wishes, unless your wish is to hear about our fabulous sponsors, Who Are You Designs. So I was tooling around on the Who Are You site tonight, and they have this great line of football humour t-shirts. There's one that's emblazoned with the word bollocks, and it features a bunch of little stick men lined up, and they've got their little stick hands over their little stick genitalia. And then there's one that screams, "I got kicked by Cantona," and it's got old Eric's bearded face looking at you, being all French and moody and stuff, so that one's good too. So, listen, if you have a sense of humour and you like football, why not share those two facts with the world? Just log on to Who Are You Designs and shop till you drop, or as this is online, shop until you develop carpal tunnel syndrome. So I, I was really proud of that joke and thought it was clever until I googled it and I discovered that studies have proved that carpal tunnel isn't actually caused by typing on a computer. Anyway, I'll be back again in a couple of weeks, possibly with a better joke. I make no promises. Back to George.
Okay, I'm joined by Jen Cooper. Jen, you obviously host our great women's soccer podcast, The Mix Zone. Thank you for joining me on Dummy.
Glad to be here.
Okay, there was some big news yesterday. It was the Women's World Cup roster being announced for the U.S. team. Initial reaction?
Well, one, I have to say, just to be a downer, it's not really big news when you kind of know who's going to be cut already and you're only cutting two players from a list of 25. Still very exciting. I love that Fox Sports 1 made a big deal about it, incorporated it into their post-Champions League broadcast, you know, so, you know, a live announcement. It was great. I can't remember them doing that in the past.
There are, what, 25 women on this roster?
There were 25 who've been in camp the last couple of camps. The FIFA World Cup roster is 23 players, so you had two cuts.
But you're telling me there's something interesting. I mean, you know, I think one thing we've seen in years past, I mean, this was especially true, I believe, under Bob Bradley. The men, you know, would cycle through so many players. And you were mentioning that the women's team hasn't really done that.
Right, especially since they got rid of Tom Sormani last April. Jill Ellis has only brought 34 players into camp over the last year, and a couple of those players have even retired. So it was a pretty thin roster to look at. And I don't want to take away anything from the quality of players who have been in camp and who have been on the roster, because they are our best players in many ways. But you always have to be looking towards the future as much as you are looking in the present. And what a lot of people aren't aware of is that the provisional roster for the World Cup, all teams are allowed to name 35 players, and then you cut it down to 23. So, you know, the U.S. was naming this roster way before they had to, but I agree with Jill's idea of, okay, we name this now so the players know what's what and they can plan accordingly. And, you know, and it was pretty clear after the friendly in St. Louis who she was going to cut based on who, you know, didn't really get playing time at all. But I'd be fascinated to know who's going to be on that 35 player roster when there haven't even been 35 players called in the last year. And it's not clear from the FIFA regulations if it's something they have to do, supposed to do, or they can do, because it says, you know, each delegation shall submit a list of 35 names. And it specifies too that there has to be a fourth keeper. She hasn't given caps to anyone but those three since last summer. So
maybe that's Abby. You know, we can get her in there, and then that way we don't have to take off another. Anyway, let me ask you this. I want to dive into just a couple of key positions. The defense,
okay.
The U.S. website has they've put asterisks behind each player's name to denote how many World Cups they've been in. And obviously, when you look at that, Christy Rampone has the most asterisks. She played in the 99 tournament. She's the only player left from that one. But the rest of the defense has, I think, max, you know, they've only played in one before. This will be for even the most, experienced defenders, this will only be the second Women's World Cup. What does that say about the team? Is the defense a young, sort of untested part of the team that we should maybe be a little worried about?
Well, it amuses me that you would refer to anybody as having only played in one World Cup.
right.
You know, and your untested defense are people that have, you know, 70, 80 caps to their names. So it's all a matter of perspective. Sure, you look at Julie Johnston, who had a breakout tournament last month in the Algarve, and she's only got six senior caps to her name, but she was the captain of the under-20 team in 2012 that won the under-20 Women's World Cup. They had lost to Germany in the group stage, beat them in the final. You know, these girls have experience. They're just not getting more experience at the senior level the way they should. One thing I think the U.S. has always done well but could do better is mixing the young players with those veterans. And that's the value of someone like a Christy Rampone, even if she's not on the field, is to bring that maturity and experience and leadership to the young players and, you know, show them how to not be pressured when things get tense.
One area that I look at and I think, wow, there is a lot of talent here, is the forward line. You know, Alex Morgan, everyone knows, Abby Wambach, amazing, amazing legend already. And Kristen Press, who we did a story on in an earlier edition of Howler, has really come into her own and sort of become, you know, I think a great partner with Morgan up top. And we're leaving out Sidney LaRue, of course, and Amy Rodriguez, both of whom are very capable strikers and very exciting. How do you see that those players splitting time? I mean, what kind of strategy do you think that you think we'll employ when it comes to that sort of, you know, player management, bringing on players late? How does that look to you?
Well, there's going to have to be a different approach to player management this tournament than in previous tournaments. One, it's a longer tournament. For the first time, you've got 24 teams, so there is actually a round of 16, which means if you got to the final, you have played six games, as to before it was you've played five if you got to the final. You also have, of course, the turf issue, which affects some players more than others, and specifically, I'm talking about that's probably going to be more of a grind on Abby than anyone else. And then you throw in the possibility that there could be some tough travel. Get this, if the U.S. finishes second in their group, they will have to fly from Vancouver to Moncton to then play the winner of Group E, which would likely be Brazil. And they would have one less day rest than the winner of Group E.
I'm ashamed to say my Canadian geography is not all that. I think Moncton is on the Far East Coast.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. They're basically flying from Hawaii to New York.
Oh, yeah. That's a long
time. Yeah. Okay. that's pretty tough. So the rotation of those forwards is going to be so huge. And, you know, we have to feel lucky having five excellent forwards that each bring something different, so you can vary your attack based on your opponent, health issues, travel issues, who's hot at the time. You know, really my only concern right now is Sidney LaRue, who just, you know, hasn't seen a lot of time, hasn't had a great run the past few months. You know, it's like if we can just get her on track, you will have five unstoppable forwards.
Now talk to me about the midfield. Who's running the show? I mean, I think in years past it's been Lauren Holiday. Is that still the case?
Yes and no. We've been trying to figure out how you refer to the midfield formation. And really what we started calling it the last couple of games was the rocket ship, that you kind of had this flat back four with this tower of six midfielders coming out in front of it. Yeah, that's the best thing. We've seen a lot of experimentation by Jill Ellis with Holiday and Carly Lloyd and Morgan Bryan. And now Rapinoe is back from injury. So I'm not really clear who's going to be running the show. I sense that it's going to be Carly Lloyd, if for no other reason that she's the one that just kind of digs in and says, fine, I'll put this whole game on my shoulders and I'll get it done.
Well, she, of course, scored the winning goal in the last two Olympic finals for us, which is, you know, that's just so clutch. And, you know, you want to have a player like that who wants to be in those big games and really proven to score goals in big games. That's key. Let me ask you this. Hope Solo is on the roster, obviously. She was dropped not too long ago, not for playing reasons. But I imagine that if she's on this team, she has to be starting, because just I can only imagine how disruptive it would be to have Hope Solo in the locker room and not playing.
Well, I think it's less a factor of her as a disruption in the locker room and more a factor that your two backup keepers have had a combined seven caps between them. It's one of my ongoing complaints that, you know, we have these friendlies and even qualifiers against pretty weak opponents, and they're still putting in Hope. They're still putting in Hope. You know, you had a lot of games last summer and last fall where we could have seen Ashlyn Harris, we could have seen Alyssa Nair, but no, they put in Hope. So here she has, I think, about 170 caps now, and Nair and Harris have a combined seven. So clearly she's the number one keeper for the team. Clearly she's the number one keeper in the world. But my concern is always, you have to be prepared for every possibility. What if she got injured? What if you have a ridiculous call like you did in 1995 and Brianna Scurry got a red card and they had to throw Mia Hamm in goal?
Right.
You know, so I feel like it's ignoring a big chunk of our game. Of course, if she's good, if she's even, you know, remotely healthy, you want Hope Solo in goal, but you have to be prepared for the what if. I think of England-France in 2011, their quarterfinal went to PKs, and it was so clear that none of the English players other than Kelly Smith wanted to take one. They hadn't even practiced them. It's like, you're going into a knockout game. How can you not be prepared for that?
Mm-hmm. Now, last question. When you look at this roster, is there anybody who you think could become, I mean, you know, in every tournament like this, someone, sometimes a couple people, really become elevated and sort of reach the consciousness of the American public, who is poised to sort of be that person on this roster?
I think it's Kristen Press and Carly Lloyd. And I put two because one, you know, we talked about Carly scoring game-winning goal in two Gold Cup matches, but she still hasn't reached that everybody knows who she is kind of level of, you know, Morgan, LaRue, Wambach, Solo. So I say it's Carly Lloyd, it's Clutch Carly, and also Kristen Press, who, you know, has finally seen regular time on the U.S. national team. She didn't get her first cap till 2013, you know, and she's ready to have a breakout tournament.
I think they heard we were doing a story on her. That's probably why.
That's probably why.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, we'll keep believing that. And in the meantime, Jen, thank you so much for joining me. This has been great. And I just want to encourage everybody again to check out your podcast. If you want to get ready for the Women's World Cup, there's really nothing better you can do than spend an hour a week listening to you and the really amazing guests you've had on. I'm really impressed. They're better than the ones we get.
I like to hear that.
Except and for of course.
And of course, I've got the daily World Cup trivia countdown on keepernotes.com. So if you really like stats or obscure videos, you got to check out keepernotes.com.
Yes. All right, Jen, thanks again. Appreciate it.
All right.
Okay, Tiki Taka. Danny, I know you're excited about your Tiki Taka. I am pretty excited about my Tiki Taka. David, why don't you go first?
Well, my Tiki Taka is a new book that is about to be published called 56, The Story of the Bradford Fire. And as you may know, it's the 30th anniversary this year of the terrible fire in the stand at Bradford City that killed 56 people. And the Premier League, I think all of English football will be holding a minute's silence to mark the tragedy. And one of the survivors, Martin Fletcher, has written this book on 30 years of painstaking investigation. He lost four or five other members of his family in the fire. And what he argues is if you look at the guy who owned Bradford City at the time, this was not the first fire with which he was connected. Indeed, eight other properties commercially linked to this man in the area went up in flames in a kind of decade or so around the Bradford fire. And while, of course, this is not conclusive evidence of anything, if you ask any fire investigation department, they said, you know, coincidences happen. Big coincidences mean that it's probably not a coincidence. So I just think it's a moment. Check it out. People need to make their own decision. I need to go and read the details. But, you know, this is one of the this is a really important thing in the history of English football. 56 people died. And it just strikes me that this is worth another look.
Danny, why don't you give us your Tiki Taka?
Yeah, so leaving my European love and going down to South America, in Bolivia specifically, a Bolivian side called Universitario de Sucre.
Danny,
yes.
Let me just interrupt. Your Spanish is
improving,
sexier and sexier by the week.
Is improving.
Those R's, I mean.
Gracias.
And it's too bad you're moving from Miami. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but wow. Okay.
Thank you. So they visited Bolivar in a league fixture this weekend, and they played last night in the Copa Libertadores as well. And the club were furious that the Bolivian FA wouldn't push or change the schedule. So they ended up fielding seven players for their game against Bolivar, who are top of the table. Those seven players were all youth team players. Now we have, you know, the seven players is the minimum amount of players you can have on the field in order to actually have a game. And then all those guys, none of them were actual pros. They were all just youngsters. And Bolivar's top of the table. So it only took a minute and like 13 seconds for them to score. After 7 minutes, Bolivar scored again. And then after 13 minutes, one of the youngsters, who was playing, I think right back in their, audacious 3-2-1 formation, just like collapsed with a thigh injury, And he had to be carted off. So they didn't have enough players to finish the game. So the game was, you know, it was called off.
Like a mercy rule there.
Yeah, exactly. So it was actually called off. Bolivar was given, like, I think, an automatic 3-0 victory. But the good news is that they played last night. Universitario played last night. They played Mineros of Venezuela, I believe, in the Copa Libertadores. And they won 2-0. So the tactics worked.
Wow. Okay.
and they're top of the table, actually, of their group in the Copa Libertadores. So it's not all doom and gloom for Universitario de Sucre.
That's fantastic. We're going to come back to that story. Well, Danny, you need to update us not only so we can find out what happens to them, but so we can keep hearing you say it again.
Universitario de Sucre.
Yes, and I'm going to ask Ryan to get some like Olé sound effects or something every time. Okay. All right, guys.
All right, dude.
Wait, beautiful. I haven't given my tiki taka.
Sorry.
I got a real David.
He was excited, Dave.
Normally, I'd be like, "All right, thanks. Good. I can avoid it." But this one's pretty amazing. Have you guys ever heard about the Caribbean Cup? Is this something that's on your radar? I mean, I don't know if it's around anymore.
No.
Well, there was a game in the '94. It was actually in the qualification round to make it to the Caribbean Cup. Barbados versus Grenada. I think you pronounce this country Grenada, right? You guys know? Anyway, it ended 4-2. Okay. But the story is really incredible. So basically they were playing each other. It was in a three team group. Puerto Rico was the third team. And coming into the game, both teams, Barbados and Grenada, had a chance to advance into the tournament proper. Okay. If Barbados won by two or more goals, they would go through. Otherwise, Grenada was going to go through. It was one or the other. And there was this quirky rule that the organizers put in, and it was, very short-lived rule. Basically, if a game went to a tie, they didn't want any ties. So if a game was tied at the end of 90 minutes, it would go to golden goal. But the tweak is they said a golden goal would be worth two goals. I'm not sure why. Okay. So basically, Barbados goes ahead. They're winning 2-0. And so everything's going well. Grenada gets a goal back. So suddenly, even though Grenada's losing, they're going to go through because Barbados hasn't reached the 2-goal lead that they need to go through. And so around the 87th minute, Barbados decides, you know what? We need this game to go to extra time because if it goes to extra time and then we score the golden goal, we'll go through because we'll have that 2-goal advantage. Okay. So Barbados in the 87th minute decides to score an own goal. They do that. The game is now 2-2. And it's going to go to extra time. But what that meant was that basically Grenada, remember, could still lose by a goal and go through. They just couldn't tie because that would send it to overtime. So for the last 3 minutes of regulation and then whatever was left in injury time, basically Grenada could score in Barbados's goal or their own goal and they would go through. So you have the situation. You have the situation where Barbados is defending both goals. He's trying to score in both goals. It's like a training.
It's a training exercise. Yeah, exactly.
And somehow Barbados keeps Grenada out. They aren't able to score any goal. Like, I don't, like, you know, it sounds absolutely unbelievable. I wish I could see this. I don't think there's footage. We've looked. But if we manage to dig any up before this goes live, we will put video of it. But basically the game goes to extra time. Barbados scores pretty soon into extra time and they officially win 4-2 because that golden goal gave them 2 goals and they moved on to the proper Caribbean Cup tournament and didn't do that very well there. But it's absolutely amazing. So, I mean, I could not believe, and I have to give credit to Marshall Doig. He's one of our copy editors on the magazine, and he sent me the Wikipedia page for this, and it actually took me down kind of a rabbit hole. There are a bunch of games. I mean, the highest margin ever was a game in Antananarivo where a team put in 149 own goals in protest of something. And so, you know,
In The Ball Is Round.
Yes. That's right.
I wrote a whole thing on that. It was crazy. Nonstop. How many can you get in?
That's right.
You've got to work hard to score 149 penalties, right? Yeah, score, okay. You know, kickoffs and everything.
No, totally. I mean, that's you're going pretty fast there. And then there was another one in Southeast Asia where I forget who was playing, but both teams basically wanted to avoid the host Vietnam in the semifinal. So the goalkeeper put in an own goal to avoid that for one of the teams, and he was actually banned for life over this, which I thought was kind of harsh. But anyway, it's a really, I loved that story, Barbados versus Grenada, because, you know, I guess, you know, when I play like Settlers of Catan, which is a pretty popular board game, I have a friend who, he'll decide, you know, I don't actually care about winning. I want to end the game with the most sheep. And he'll tell people he wants the most sheep card. And so, but what it does is it totally skews the game. I mean, it changes the rules of the game for everybody. And so, you know, I just love the idea that all of a sudden Grenada can find itself in a position where they have to score in their own goal or the, I mean, it's just so wacky. But anyway.
That all boils down to the two-pointer as well.
The two-pointer. That's right. I'm actually in favor of bringing it back. I think there would be some great confusion.
Yeah, no, we need to engineer more of these situations in more games.
It would make like Champions League aggregate way more exciting, wouldn't it?
Can you imagine? It's like shooting the moon in Hearts. Like, okay, like, all right, you have to win the game, but if you lose by the X number, then you actually win. I don't know. It would be really fantastic. Anyway, that's my Tiki Taka. I was really happy with that one. Thanks, Marshall. Okay, a big thank you to David and Danny and Jen Cooper. You should listen to her podcast, The Mix Zone. It's in the Howler feed. You've probably noticed it. It's really great, and it'll get you ready for the Women's World Cup this summer. A quick reminder, if you're in New York City, I would love for you to join us on Saturday night for the game Rowdies versus Cosmos out at Hofstra. All the details, how to get out there, the ticket prices and how to buy them and all that stuff, it's on our website, howlermagazine.com. Just scroll down. I think it's like two stories down by now. I want to thank our sponsors, Who Are You Designs. I met one of the co-founders of Who Are You this past weekend. She's really nice, and I thanked her for sponsoring our show because they make it possible for us to make it for you every week. And, of course, I'd like to thank the Howler Singers. They're actually members of a choral ensemble called Ghostlight. If you come out on Saturday, you're going to meet one of them, my old friend Lindsay Elliott. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. Howler Radio and Dummy and all of our podcasts are produced by Matthew Nelson with help from Ryan Catanese and Kira Deppenbrock. My name is George Qureshi. I'll be back with you next week with all the rest of these dummies. And remember, if you listen to Dummy, you will never listen alone.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are You? Check out WhoAreYouDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are You has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's DUMMY. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYouDesigns.com.